Let's start this talk. The last of these talks on the Four Noble Truths. And this is the last of the three talks on the Eightfold Path. So the last three steps on the Eightfold Path, wise effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. This is often thought of as, and sometimes actually called bhavana. Bhavana means practice. So this is like the steps that describe how we actually practice. On the cushion, you know, in a formal way, maybe even not on the cushion, because you could be doing walking practice or something, but this is formal practice discussion. I suppose you can call it that. And so the first of these is wise effort. Sometimes it's called wise energy. The word virya, which is used, translates in both those ways. And so here you are, you've figured out you want to practice, you've set the intention to practice, you've got your external life in order. Now this question arises, how much energy, how much effort should I actually put into the practice? It's a normal thing to think, a logical thing to think. And I want to start by reading something from Ajahn Chah's book, Being Dharma. When I first read this several years ago, I went, ah, yes, this, I liked what he said. Practice really has to depend on steadfastness and patient endurance. Some people start to practice meditation and they have ideas and desires as to how they want it to be. They expect the mind to be calm right away. But the old seeds and habits of turmoil are there. So the practitioners will have to experience their ripening. It is important to make efforts where this distress appears. We might feel we should be fine without such disciplines that cause us to feel bothered and oppressed. We could eat and sleep in comfort and at will. We could talk about whatever we like when we have the urge. We could go here and there as we wish and follow our impulses, like this would bring well-being. The teachings of the Buddha talks about resisting, grating against things. It's a great image, grating against things. The way of transcendence grates against the worldly. Right view grates against wrong view. Purity grates against impurity. These things are always going to be incompatible. In the scripture, there's a fable to illustrate this. Before the Buddha attained enlightenment, when he was accepted and eaten rice porridge from the milkmaid Sujata, he set the dish on the surface of a southerly flowing river and made the aspiration, if I'm going to become a supremely awakened Buddha, may this dish flow north. So the water's flowing south, the dish goes against the current, right? The dish flowed to the north. This, we have to understand that we need to apply effort because we're going against the current of our culture, the current of society, the current of our habitual patterns. But even that, it's like, yeah, okay, I can sort of accept that. But, and there's always a but, right? If you read a lot of Buddhist literature and scripture and commentary, we're told, for instance, that we all have Buddha nature, that we all have innately Buddha nature, bodhicitta, is this there? We just don't know it yet. That we're perfect just as we are. So if we're perfect, why do I need to practice? It's a logical question if you take it on the surface, let alone put any effort into it, right? And the simplest explanation of this is in terms of absolute reality. You know, the Buddha often speaks in these terms of absolute reality and relative reality, the world we live in, the day-to-day world. In terms of absolute reality, we are perfect. Absolutely true. But we don't live in the world of absolute reality too often. At least I don't. So, you know, we live in the world of day-to-day relative reality, and we keep getting caught and we keep struggling. And we don't know this perfection. You know, the world seems like it's just full of suffering, and we're far anything but perfect. So what do we do now? Well, once again, there's lots of teachings that say we have to, you know, just let go. We have to sink into our this true nature, this bodhicitta. But paradoxically, letting go isn't easy. Because what are we letting go of? We're letting go of our usual reactive habits of mind. That's what we have to let go of. But before we can do that, we have to actually see these reactive patterns of mind. And then we have to practice to see how we can gradually shift those reactive habits of mind. This takes a lot of energy and a lot of effort, as I'm sure you all know from practicing. It's like most of the time we're just caught in these stories about what's going on, and we don't really see clearly. And to actually see clearly and be aware of what's actually arising in the moment all the time takes an enormous amount of effort and practice. So here's another thought. This Pali word virya I mentioned, which I said is often translated as effort or energy. Actually, the root of that word, a lot of languages are constructed in pieces and they put them together to get other words, right? So the root of virya is vira, which means hero. Have you ever practiced yoga? You run across the Vira Bhadrasana, the hero pose, right? So what this is implying is that not only do we need to put energy into the practice, it takes courage. We have to actually courageously put effort into it. And the courage is because we're going against what our culture believes and teaches us. We're going against these habitual patterns of mind and habitual cultural patterns. But we have to be careful. If we put too much effort, if we strain, if we overdo it, that's equally going to be a problem. Because we'll get burnt out. Hot topic these days, burnout. But often when we try too hard, when we really push in our practice, it's because we have this idea that somehow I have to do this to succeed. I have to somehow become perfect. That I have some sense of obligation to practice, that I should be practicing hard all the time. This doesn't work either. This just eventually turns the practice into this sort of cold, grim duty. We have to have this balance of the practice. We have to enjoy our practice. What a radical idea, actually enjoy your practice. Huh? But we have to sort of have this sense of, this is nice. I mean, it's not always easy. In fact, sometimes it's miserable, but it can be miserable and nice at the same time, really. because you get this sense that, oh, you're seeing something clearly, maybe for the first time. So how do we go about actually doing this? How do we go about finding this right effort, this wise effort, this skillful effort? Well, luckily, there's a very traditional teaching that has like the four aspects of right effort. And I want to spend some time talking about those four aspects. And the first, and they all seem so obvious. And at the same time, don't be surprised if you, even though they seem really obvious, we do exactly the opposite a lot of the time. First of these is to do whatever you can to prevent unwholesome states of mind from arising. Do whatever you can to prevent unwholesome states of a mind from arising. And this means we have to actually have to pay attention. And as we see an unwholesome state arising, we might quite skillfully go, oh, I don't need to do that. I don't need to act in this way, speak in this way, think in this way even. It's not easy, because a lot of those unwholesome ways of thinking and acting are deeply embedded mental patterns, cultural patterns that we sort of adopted as being right. And this also seems to contradict the thought we often have about practice, where we just have to be with whatever is arising. And that's a good, very good beginner instruction. Because just to be with what's arising is the first step, because then you start to notice what's actually arising. But eventually, in your practice, you get to the point where you go, oh, I've been here before. I've seen this movie many times. I've very carefully paid attention to it and taken it in and sat with it and become okay with it and accepted it and all those things we do with unwholesome mind states. And so sometimes at a certain point, it's like, you just go, nah. It's also very good at this point to have a good sense of humor, to be able to actually laugh at yourself, like, oh God, that one again, and have a little giggle about it. Actually, it's sometimes quite a skillful thing to do, to sort of laugh at yourself in a friendly way, not in a you bad person you way. You're not laughing at yourself, you're laughing with yourself. There's a good way to put it, perhaps. Because a lot of these things, when you see them and you start to actually see them for what they are, it's like, what? How ridiculous this is. How totally ridiculous this is. So this also means, however, you know, if we're actually going to prevent unwholesome states of mind from arising, that we start to consciously examine our life in the world. Part of right effort at this point is, you know, what happens when I hang out with those people or go to that place or watch that kind of movie on TV? Like, a long time ago, I had to absolutely stop watching really violent things. I just couldn't, because every time I did, I could just feel my mind being totally agitated. So I just stopped. You know, I love watching things like Downton Abbey. You know, that are sort of they're sweet, but they're not like, there's not that, you know, and all these things with special effects and scary things and all that stuff. I'm not totally uninterested, because I know what happens to my mind when I do that. And that was just like a conscious choice I made quite a while ago. And so on. So we start taking a look at all the aspects of our life, all the things we do, and we go, does this lead to wholesomeness, or does this lead to unwholesome states of mind? Am I setting myself up to end up in an unwholesome state of mind? Oh, maybe I won't do that anymore. You know, it starts to be sensible. So the second aspect of right effort, to do whatever you can to get rid of unwholesome mind states once they have arisen. This, number one, this acknowledges the fact that you're not perfect, and sure enough, you're going to be in the middle of some mental storm. And then mindfulness will creep in, and you'll go, oh, it's that, as your mind rages along. You know, but even being able to be mindful of it and step back and go and label it, name it, note it. Particularly if this is happening in sitting practice, this is a really skillful thing to do, is just to be able to go, oh, it's that. Actually, give it a name often, if because a lot of these are recurring patterns. So some of the recurring patterns, you give them funny little names. It's just like, helps you laugh at them, number one. And number two, it's like, oh, it's that, it's just that again. And often just that, that there you are in the in this storm of unwholesomeness. And you go, oh, that's what this is. I know it. And then you don't beat yourself up. Very important. You have to accept it. This is just the nature of my mind. Sometimes I get caught in these crazy mental storms. And then just decide to, if you can just be sort of step back from the story a little bit, then you start to see it as just another, just the story. It's just thoughts flowing through the mind. And now you're just being mindful of them. I mean, it may be still be quite unpleasant because it's, you know, some of these stories are quite unpleasant, but if you're mindful of the fact that you're listening to the story or watching this movie in your mind, now it's just another thing to be mindful of. So mindfulness is the key here to not getting deeper into this unwholesome mind state and actually going, I can step back from this. Even if you can't stop it in the sense of it's like it's an onrushing story, and but at least you're mindful of the fact that you're in the middle of this storm. Hard to do. I'm not saying this is in any sense easy. Because these when we're caught in these mental storms, is often a very strong emotional hook that we've bitten down on. You know, I like to think of this like a, you know, we're a fish. This, the mind drops these hooks with these juicy bait. We floats along. We chomp down on it, and sure enough, there we are flopping around on the hook. So even though we're flopping around on the hook, at least now we can be aware that we're flopping around on the hook. No, maybe I don't need to. Next time I see that bait, maybe I'll be a little less likely to bite down on it. Also, there are a lot of teachings around things you can do when you see this unwholesome mind state that's already there, full-blown arisen unwholesome mind state. Often these stories have to do with, I call them stories intentionally because often this is what they are, they're stories in the mind, have to do with some individual or group of people or something like that. And then if you can shift the story to one of loving kindness towards that person, it just changes the quality of the mind. If you can sincerely hold that person in your heart, and instead of ranting to yourself about them, you open your heart to them. That often will take the power away from that story, that unwholesome mind state that's arisen, and just wash it away. So, and this isn't like, oh, I'm going to get rid of that horrible story by being nice to him. Yeah, I can be nice to him. Like, it's got to be genuine. It can't be sort of put on like an attitude thing, you know? It's kind of like, I really got to mean this. Once again, not easy. And there's another thing I want to mention here. This is a great Joseph Goldstein story that I really like. Oops. And he's talking about these ways of actually dissipating these unwholesome mind states if they've arisen. One way of doing this is imagining oneself shooting down these thoughts as soon as they arise, like shooting down targets at an amusement park shooting gallery. I found this method particularly helpful with recurrent unwholesome thoughts that have already been seen so many times that it's not a question of denial or suppression of the feelings. Here, it's an attitude that takes no quarter, but involves a sense of humor. I call this cowboy dharma. See how he's made it kind of funny. He has a name for it. It's like, you know, you're just sort of shooting down these thoughts as they arise in his mind. That's works for him. Maybe some other thing. Maybe, you know, for you it's like pushing them all underwater or lassoing them, or who knows. I mean, everybody has their own way of imaging things. I'm not particularly crazy about the gun image myself, but that's just me. But it's interesting that he's taking quite a it's forceful. Like sometimes you have to like, okay, that's it. I've had it with this stuff. I can do something about it right now. This is once again, so we're saying we don't always have to just sort of whatever's arising, I'm stuck with this and wallow in it. Sometimes the skillful thing to do is to say, okay, enough already. I've had enough. I'm stepping back. If you have one of these recurring patterns, day after day after day in your daily practice, or if you're on retreat and you have it three or four times in one day, this is when you got to have cowboy dharma. You have to go, okay, I've looked at this, I've been open about it, I've accepted it, this is part of what arises in my mind, but no, I'm not going to, not anymore, thank you very much. Okay, so that's the second aspect of right effort. Do whatever you can to get rid of unwholesome mind states that have already arisen. So then the other two are sort of the flip side of the first two. So the third aspect of right effort is do whatever you can to cultivate wholesome mind states. Seems real obvious, huh? Well, yeah, well, I should do whatever I can to cultivate wholesome mind states. Do things that bring calm and joy and compassion and loving kindness and equanimity. But how often do we actually consciously choose to do those things? We may stumble into them. We may, you know, sometimes out of habit find them again. But how often do we actually consciously choose to live our lives in this way, cultivating wholesome mind states? You have to think about all the choices you make in the mind. And the deciding factor is this wholesome or not? Does this lead towards enlightenment or not? And choose the ones that are wholesome and lead towards enlightenment. Cultivate wholesome mind states, literally. Okay. Fourth and final aspect of right effort is when wholesome mind states have arisen in the mind, do whatever you can to preserve them. So there you are, you're just innocently sitting there doing your practice, and you go, oh, I'm really calm. Just you notice it. And when you're really calm, you notice it. It's like a distinct body sensation, among other things. Also a distinct mental sensation of clarity and stillness. Now we have to actually take action. We have to apply effort to sort of see, let's keep this around for a while. It's so sweet. Let's enjoy this and keep it around for a while. But what happens instead often? One is we find ourselves in this calm, peaceful mind state. Or this, we're full of joy, or we feel equanimous, even just one of those wholesome mind states has arisen. And we immediately start thinking about, uh-oh, I better be careful or this is going to go away. I just grasped onto it, right? Well, now I'm shift shifted to an unwholesome mind state, just like that. So I'm trying to make it stay. I'm trying to hold on to it. I want it to be like this all the time. That's different from accepting that a wholesome mind state has risen, and let's not mess with it. You know? Often also we get caught in these spaces where we judge ourselves. Oh, I'm not worthy. I'm not good enough to be this happy, to be this calm, to be this whatever. I don't deserve these wholesome mind states. I haven't practiced enough yet to hang out here. And all of those thoughts are unwholesome mind states. And as soon as you shift the mind to an unwholesome mind state, the wholesome one disappears. We can't judge these things. You can't either blame yourself or take credit for them. That's a two-sided coin. But we have to be able to go, yeah, I think I'll just hang out here. Not in a way that's going to try to hold on to it, but just sort of, there's an old hippie phrase about going with the flow. And I think it's actually very appropriate here. Sometimes when these wholesome mind states have arisen, you want to go with the flow. So it's like, what I'm saying is you have to learn through practice that it's okay to be calm. It's okay to be joyful. It's okay to let yourself be filled with wholesome mind states. There's nothing wrong with it at all. It's not that you shouldn't cling to them. Your practice shouldn't become, oh, I want to make that wholesome mind state arise again, because now you're just clinging to it again. But when they do arise, which they always do, and you all know that too, you all had wholesome mind states arise in your practice. It's like, just, I'm going to keep paying attention to my primary object, whatever that is, and just hang out here and let this be. Because we all know these are mind states. Mind states arise, they're there for a while and they're gone. It's going to go eventually anyway. So let's just enjoy it while it's here. I know it's going to go, but I also know that it's here right now. Let's enjoy it. Let's accept it and enjoy it. That's wise effort. Sometimes effort is subtle. It's not like forceful at all. It's like the effort here is like, let's just not rock the boat. Let's just go with the flow. Okay. This doesn't just happen. There's no magic to right effort. This is just practice where you actually consciously, see one of these four things and going, oh, this is where I have to apply that aspect of right effort. And we learn through skill, through practice, to steer our practice a little bit as much as we can. Okay. So then we've laid all of the foundation for the precise mental practice of mindfulness and concentration. But remember, mindfulness and concentration are wholesome mind states. We can't practice them. We can only practice creating the causes and conditions such they might arise. That's really what the whole mindfulness practice is. It's a way of creating causes and conditions so that mindfulness will arise and concentration will arise. These are wholesome mind states. Just like all wholesome mind states, they're going to arise, they're going to be there for a while, and then they're going to go away. You also have to accept that. sometimes that's the hardest thing to accept, actually. So mindfulness, the word for that is, you see this in the text, is vipassana, mindfulness. That's how it's translated. There's many, many different techniques of mindfulness. You know, the one I teach and the one I practice is this one of noting. And that's, it suits me, but there's lots of other ways to approach mindfulness practice. But how do we recognize mindfulness? How do we know, that's what this is mindfulness, you know what are its qualities? So, and this is a classic list of qualities that I came across that I found quite useful. Number one is not forgetting. If you're mindful, you're not forgetting that you're doing actually practicing. Now, often what happens is we're practicing, the mind goes, oh yeah, that thing, blah, blah, and now we've forgotten that we're practicing. So one way of thinking of mindfulness is simply not forgetting. You're staying firmly on the object of meditation. An image I like, and this is my carpenter handyman mind, I like that it's like you're putting a post in the ground and you're putting in cement and maybe some rebar, and it's going to be really solid. That's what my mind should be like. It should be solid like that post in the ground. But it takes a lot of effort to put that post in the ground so it's solid. Very significant for me right now because I'm actually helping build a big deck up at Rocky Mountain Eco Dharma Center, and we're putting in these massive stone and cement footings and things. Anyhow, second quality, presence, which in this case means not looking away, which is often what happens, you know. When does this sweet stuff is happening? Sure, it's easy to hang out and look at that. But what if something happens that isn't very pleasant at all? Aversion arises and we go, oh, I'm not gonna look at that. Don't wanna think about that. I'm gonna step back from that. I'm gonna keep my distance. That's not having presence. Here's another one, remembering. Good translation of the word sati, remembering. I want to read something from Joseph Goldstein's book and then talk about this a bit. He's talking about different aspects of mind. The third aspect of sati, what we translate as mindfulness, is one that we don't often associate with mindfulness, but in fact, it harkens back to its root meaning of remembering. Here, mindfulness calls to mind or remembers what is skillful and what is not, what is inferior and what is refined, what is beneficial and what is harmful. It is this aspect of mindfulness that makes it possible to follow the Buddha's instructions to let go and abandon what is unskillful and to develop and cultivate what is skillful. Ah, there's the four layers of right effort right there, right? Mindfulness thus becomes a key factor in strengthening our inner moral compass. If we don't remember and call to mind what is wholesome and what is not, then we simply toss about on waves of habitual mind states, often acting out latent tendencies of different defilements. It sounds pretty grim, right? But it also tends to be a little grim sometimes. But it's like this idea that remembering is part of the practice. And another way I like to think of it is, and I sort of described this earlier on, is not forgetting. The opposite of not forgetting is also remembering, right? It's like you're constantly remembering that you're practicing. Yeah. You're practicing, you're watching the breath, you're paying attention, you're noting what's arising, everything's kind of calm, and then off you go someplace. But at some point, you remember. oh, I'm practicing. And you go back to your object. And it might be that as going back to the object, you're noting the fact that you didn't remember, you're noting your anxiety about that, or you're noting the mental stuff that arises when you've caught yourself yet again wandering, right? Those are just things to note. And then the last one of these, and I like this one. This is mindfulness is often associated with wisdom. In the sense of simplicity. You know, the instruction I often give when I teach meditation is just sit and know you are sitting. Actually know that that's what's happening right now. So this is, it's like, it's simple. It's like, just pay attention to all those, that flood of sensation you're having right now. They all are saying in capital letters, sitting. You're not standing, you're not walking, you're not doing anything, you're sitting. Just sit and know you are sitting. As opposed to not making up stories about what's actually arising, which is often what happens. Especially as the mind gets stiller and calmer, something arises and we start making up this story about what's happening. We're not paying attention to what's actually happening anymore. Now we're creating a story, a layer of thought on top of the actual things that are happening that can take us miles away from actually being mindful. I'll tell you a rather funny personal example of this, actually. This is on one of my long retreats. And my teacher at that point said, do you wake up in the middle of the night sometimes? I said, yeah, sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, whatever. He says, you should just get up and meditate right then. See what happens. Well, teacher thought it was a good idea. Sure, I'll try that. So I where I'm sleeping is very close to the meditation hall. So I wake up, it's 2 in the morning. It's like dark outside. There's no one around. I get up, put on a few clothes, go into the meditation hall, go sit on my cushion. I'm the only one there. There is no one else in this huge meditation hall that usually has 100 people in it. And it's kind of nice. It's like, I can see why he suggested it. I'm thinking this is kind of, it's very quiet. And there's no one rustling and moving around. And it's just, I sort of see a little bit of moonlight coming through the windows. But then I hear this sound, this sort of gurgly sort of sound. And because everything else is so quiet, I'm going, what the heck is that? It's like, I can't figure out where this gurgly sound, like there are pipes, this is a big building and there's pipes and stuff, but I can't, what's going on with this gurgly sound? And somehow, fairly quickly, my mind gets to this place where just outside the meditation hall, there's this lovely pool, right literally against the wall with a Buddha statue in it. And in my mind, I think, oh my God, someone's fallen into the pool and drowned, and they're blocking the output filter, and that's what's making this gurgling sound. And I'm like, I become convinced that this is absolutely true. And I keep saying, oh no, you're just making this up. This is like blah, blah, blah. Don't pay attention. Go back to paying attention to your breath, blah, 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 blah. Count to 10 backwards or something, just do anything. But this story is so powerful. I actually had to stand up, go out of the hall, and look in the pool. Course, there's no one there, right? No body floating around. But it's like, I just made up this entire story from one little recurring sound. All it was the normal, I think probably they changed the water in the pool every night at 2 in the morning when no one's around, so the sucking noise wouldn't bother anybody, right? And it was just like the normal sounds of the cycling of the water in the pool. But I was convinced. I mean, I was like convinced. And I was like, oh, I have to go wake up the managers. And I mean, I was like, oh my God, I'll have to give testimony to the police when they come, because I'll be the one who finds the body. I mean, it's like the whole story was just enormous, but it was just like nonsense. Just one little sound. So don't be surprised if you have your own body in the pool moments. It's just part of practice. One more thing about mindfulness. This is actually a quote in Joseph's book from Bhikkhu Bodhi, talking about bare attention or right mindfulness. In the practice of right mindfulness, the mind is trained to remain in the present, open, quiet, and alert, contemplating the present event. All judgments and interpretations have to be suspended, or if they occur, just registered and dropped. The task is simply to note whatever comes up just as it is occurring, riding the changes of events in the way a surfer rides the waves on the sea. The whole process is a way of coming back into the present, of standing in the here and now without slipping away, without getting swept away by the tides of distracting thoughts. To practice mindfulness is thus a matter not so much of doing, but of undoing. I love that sentence. You know, to practice mindfulness is thus a matter not so much of doing, but of undoing. Undoing those habits of mind we have. Something comes up and we have to figure it out or chase after it or think about it again, because I've only thought about this 37 times in the last 3 days. I better think about it one more time and make sure I got it right. You know, like all those habits of mind. And it's just like, no, just undo those habits of mind of following those distracting thoughts. Still a little bit of time. So then there's right mindfulness, I mean, right concentration. And I'm not going to say a lot about this. I've talked a lot about this in other talks. But I just want to make sure you understand there are two different forms of concentration. One is what we'll call single point concentration, where you choose a particular meditation object, be it the breath, a mantra, some visualization. There's lots of, once again, many different forms of and techniques within mindfulness practice that have this idea of one-pointed concentration. And there it's like you've chosen your meditation object. When the mind wanders and you remember, you wake up, you have an awakening to the fact that your mind's wandered, you just bring it back to that object. That's one form of concentration. This is what we do in metta practice in the Theravada world. Metta practice is really this form of concentration where you have this set of very simple phrases, the mind wanders, you just go back and continue repeating the phrases yet again. The other form of concentration is what we often associate with mindfulness within the Theravada tradition of momentary object, where we note something, and then 3 or 4 seconds later, we note the next thing that arises that's strong. And then 3 or 4 seconds later, we note the next thing that arises and is strong. So this is momentary concentration, but the object of meditation keeps shifting, but the concentration stays steady on the fact that this thing is shifting, that things are always changing. Just a different kind of objectness, I suppose. And I practice both of these at various times in various forms. There's not one that's better than the other. People find they like one more than the other. people tend one way more than the other. Find what works for you. I shift back and forth. I tend often these days I've been doing mainly the Vipassana momentary concentration method. I've gone through periods of time where I've done very focused just concentration, doing metta practice. In my earlier life, doing many years of mantra practice, which is a form of this kind of one-pointed concentration. Just two different ways. Thing is, we've got to pick one at any particular moment or time or sitting, perhaps. And so we have these three different aspects of bhavana, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. And we have to balance them out somehow and blend them together to practice. And that's what makes the whole practice wholesome, fruitful, useful, whatever term you want to use. So that's the end of what I want to say about the Eightfold Path, except for one more thing. When we think of a path, we think of a line going someplace. I'm not wild about that. I like to think of practice, the Eightfold Path, is more like a spiral. We start off with a basic understanding, some simple intention, the practice. We start getting our life in order. We start applying effort. We get some mindfulness. We get some concentration. And then somewhere that we spiral back and reset our understanding. Because now we've had experiences that go, oh, that's what that thing I was reading about. So our understanding deepens, our intention deepens, we start changing our life even more. We keep going around and coming back to the same step on the path many, many times. And each time we sort of look at it and go, oh, yeah, I can see a little deeper into this now than I did when I looked at it a year ago. A minute ago, who knows? And that's a natural part, a natural experience when it comes to practice. It's a cyclical process. It's not in any sense a straight line. And we're often practicing many steps. We're also often many steps are in process at the same time. It's not like there's just one step and then no others. We're taking multiple steps, like we're an eight-legged creature, and we can actually have all eight steps at once sometimes. That's what's going on. Something might be more stronger, more emphasis on one than another at any particular time. Okay. So, of course, there's always a poem that talks about this. And this is from Mary Oliver's book, Why I Wake Early. And it's called Song of the Builder. And I like this poem at this point because if we're not careful, we start making this practice into some huge, complicated thing. It's not. Really, this practice is incredibly simple. Just we have to do it. This is called the Song of the Builders. On a summer morning, I sat down on the hillside to think about God, a worthy pastime. Near me, I saw a single cricket. It was moving the grains of the hillside this way and that way. How great was its energy! How humble its effort! Let us hope it will always be like this, each of us going on in our inexplicable ways, building the universe. That's what we're doing, building the universe. Let's just dedicate the merit of our practice. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for joining me.